President Trump has gotten criticism from his own party and beyond for his response to this weekend's events in Charlottesville, Virginia, especially his initial reaction over the weekend.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country.
After facing pressure to directly denounce white supremacy, President Trump spoke again yesterday.
Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
President Trump, speaking this afternoon now at a press conference, has said he blames in part the alt-left for inciting violence in Charlottesville, saying, quote, you had a group on one side, you had a group on the other, and they came at each other with clubs, and it was vicious, and it was horrible, and it was a horrible thing to watch, and appeared to defend at least some of the participants on the white supremacist side of the rallies.
Trump isn't the first American president to deal with issues of race and white supremacy, and each era since the Civil War has had new debates, controversies, and challenges. Our next guest says each president has a responsibility to send a clear message on race, and many of them have fallen short.
Eric Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University. He's written a lot of books about American history, including Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877, Who Owns History, Rethinking the Past in a Changing World, and Battles for Freedom, the Use and Abuse of American History. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Very happy to be here.
Well, stepping away from the particulars of this moment and the current president, what ideally should be the role of an American president when speaking and acting on race?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is the president, whatever party he or she may be from, needs to condemn racism in the strongest possible language, not to make excuses for it, not to say, suggest that it's just one problem among many. I would have liked to see President Trump say, look, these are racist groups who are inciting the violence in Charlottesville, and racism has no place in America, but it is still a deep problem. Now, he edged toward that after a couple of days, as you know, you just said, you know, quoted his remarks there. But, you know, when he gave that second comment, it was like a kid eating his spinach. You know, it was obvious that these were not his words and that, you know, he didn't really find it very comfortable to say that. But more to the point, you know, this is a president who used pretty explicitly racism as part of his political campaign and, you know, appealed directly to white, what we call white nationalism or whatever term you want to use for that part of the political spectrum. So, you know, in his first statement, he was not willing to condemn people who are part, only part, not the whole thing, of his base. You want a president who will rise above that. You know, in 1963, at the height of the Birmingham crisis, President Kennedy went on TV to say the country faces a moral crisis here over racial inequality. Now, he was speaking against a lot of people who had voted for him. He carried most of the segregationist South in 1960 when the South was the so-called solid Democratic South. Kennedy was willing to confront people who had supported him. Trump is not willing to do that.
And this was a consistent theme for Democrats for a long stretch. FDR and others had to confront it, where you had a Democratic Party that was in part dependent on the support of Southern segregationists. How did that party as get to that moment you mentioned with JFK and then Lyndon Johnson, where they did make that transition?
Well, it took a good while. And, you know, FDR, who is praiseworthy on many grounds, did not really address race at all and basically said, look, I've got to get things through Congress, and the Southern Democrats control the committees. So he shied away from that. His wife, Eleanor, was much more forthright than he was on this. And, you know, for a long time, after all, the Republicans were the party of Lincoln once. And there were plenty of Republicans who spoke out very strongly about racial justice. I mean, Jacob Javits, a senator from New York State, or even Robert Taft, very conservative, but in the late 40s in the Senate, he was quite adamant about racial inequality and the need to combat it. So, you know, there's nothing, the Republican Party doesn't have to go this way, but it has since Goldwater, since Nixon's Southern strategy, and by the same token, the Democrats increasingly, for many, many complicated reasons, one of which was the migration of large numbers of blacks out of the South to the North, where they could vote, unlike in the South, and allying increasingly with the Democratic Party, which was pushing for greater racial justice. The parties have switched since, let's say, 100-some-odd years ago, when the Republicans were the party of anti-slavery and black rights, and the Democrats were the party of states' rights, slavery, and disenfranchising black people. They've switched positions now.
There was, in the 2016 campaign, a thought that maybe candidate Trump would be different than President Trump, that he would become presidential, grow in the office. Have we seen cases with past presidents where they have changed, evolved on issues of race after taking office?
Well, first of all, let me say no one in New York thought that Trump would change. You know, we knew Trump long before this, and as a celebrity, as a kind of baloney artist in New York City. With Trump, what you see is what you get. He's not going to change, so let's not hold our breath for that. And in a way, that's good in a weird sense, in that since he just speaks from the id immediately, what first comes out is what he really thinks. Later on, his advisors may kind of smooth over it, but, you know, the first statement, that is real Trump. He doesn't understand why Nazis and white supremacists ought to be condemned. You know, he just doesn't see it. So that's Trump. Later on, they say, hey, you better say something. So he does. But sure, Abraham Lincoln evolved. You know, before the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln did not support significant political and civil rights for black people. He thought the solution to the slavery question was to free the slaves, pay the slave owners monetary compensation, and then send the slaves to Africa or maybe Haiti or somewhere like that. He changed. He abandoned that. He, by the end of his life, he was much more favorably disposed toward what we would consider legal and civil equality and even black voting in some regards than he had been. People can change. I suppose one could hope that Trump will change, but it's been quite a while that he's been the same.
Talking to Eric Foner, historian at Columbia University, about race and presidential leadership. I wanted to get into the issue of the role of history and debates, still ongoing debates over the Civil War in modern-day America. This protest, of course, related to the removal of statues of Robert E. Lee, Confederate general. President Trump, in this press conference today, said George Washington was a slave owner. Well, we have to take down statues of George Washington. Can you talk about Civil War memorials and modern-day issues of race?
Did he say that? Well, it's amazing he knows anything about American history. He didn't mention that George Washington actually provided in his will for the freedom of all his slaves. Maybe worth noting by President Trump. These statues, the debate over these statues, have little to do with the actual history, the Confederacy, the Civil War. You know, the statue on the University of Virginia campus, which was the focal point for all this violence, was erected in 1924, okay? That's basically 70 years after the end of the Civil War. And they're erected much more as a statement of power at the time than as something looking back 70 years. That was a period of segregation, of lynching, of the taking away the right to vote from black people in Virginia and other southern states. And these statues were basically put up to say, we are in charge, folks. White people are in charge, and here's the symbol of them, the Confederacy. Robert E. Lee was a well-known Virginian, obviously, and there's no reason you shouldn't have a statue of Robert E. Lee in Virginia. The problem is now that the public monuments about history in the South are completely one-sided. Why don't we have a statue of John M. Langston, a black member of Congress in the 1880s from Virginia? Why don't we have statues of black Reconstruction legislators in Virginia? In other words, if all you've got is Confederate generals, you've got one piece of the region's history, but not the whole thing. What about statues to slave rebels? I mean, let's have Nat Turner. He's a Virginian. Well, he killed a lot of white people. Well, sure, so did Robert E. Lee, killed a lot of people, and yet there's no problem with a statue to him. I don't think these really have to do with history. They have to do with who's in charge. And, that's why, let's say in South Carolina, when they put the Confederate flag on the State House, which later taken down, of course, more recently, that was in the 1950s. As a statement against the civil rights movement. It had nothing to do with the Confederacy. It was kind of in your face to black people in South Carolina. You're trying to get your rights, but we want to show you who's in charge here. So, now people are trying to suggest maybe there should be a different kind of a more diversified view of Virginia society. And, you know, I would agree with that. Whether it means taking down statues is a different question, but I would say put up statues to other types of people in the history of Virginia who are not represented at all in the public monuments today.
We're talking about presidential leadership on issues of race. Historian Eric Foner is with us. He's a professor of history at Columbia University, author of a number of books, including Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from President Trump when it comes to the events in Charlottesville on issues of race and of white nationalism? Is there a past president that you think did especially well or maybe especially badly on issues of race? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with historian Eric Foner from Columbia University. We're looking at the role of presidential leadership in racially divided times.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from the president of the United States when it comes to leadership on issues of race and reactions to white supremacy? Is there a president in American history who you think did things right or wrong? And what questions do you have for our guest? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Eric, I wanted to ask you about modern-day America compared to a couple points in history when we saw the rise of the Ku Klux Klan and affiliated movements. Reconstruction era and the reaction, 1920s, you had groups of white Americans feeling economically insecure, worried that they were losing ground relative to, in particular, but not exclusively to black Americans, and that led to the rise of basically a domestic insurgency movement. Are we there again? Are we in a similar time period?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right that we have seen these kinds of things before. You know, the Know-Nothings became a rather prominent political party in the 1850s on an anti-immigrant, platform. Reconstruction, the original Ku Klux Klan was there and unfortunately succeeded in overturning biracial governments and putting the South on the path back to white supremacy. 1920s, absolutely. Internment of Japanese, you know, you can go on and on. In other words, Trump is kind of an extreme version of something that has existed in American society off and on at many points. So we shouldn't think he just landed from the moon, you know, and is completely outside of certain strands of American political culture. But with Trump, it's more explicit, so to speak. You know, at least more recently, you know, the Republican Party, since Goldwater, has been appealing to white resentment, white backlash against the gains of the civil rights movement. Nixon's Southern strategy, trying to win white Southerners to the Republicans away from the Democrats by appealing to racial fears. But it was usually done through kind of surreptitious language, law and order or reverse discrimination, whereas Trump, ever since he started campaigning against Mexicans and then the way he talked about blacks, every one of them is living in hell, you know, and they're afflicted by crime and drugs, and that's it. They have absolutely nothing to lose. That's ridiculous. You know, now they see what they have to lose. They have a president with a white nationalist in the White House, Stephen Bannon. So I don't think there's been somebody like that so close to the president, although maybe Pat Buchanan might qualify when he was working for Nixon. But, you know, Trump, so this kind of extreme, well, neo-Nazis, or you might, you know, some of them are, has not had quite the prominence in the politics that Trump is giving them today.
How much does presidential leadership matter in the sense of the bully pulpit in making some points of view acceptable, other points unacceptable on race? Does having a president who doesn't speak to issues of race empower extremes like white supremacy?
Well, Trump is, it's not simply Trump not speaking, it's what he does say when he does speak, and more to the point, maybe what his administration does. You know, you have an attorney general who is an arch segregationist, or has been, and says, well, we're no, you know, today affirmative action is to protect poor white people who are being discriminated against, you know, to the advantage of minorities, or the effort to suppress voting, not to mention Wisconsin, which is not my state, but in many states, including Wisconsin, all these efforts to suppress voting by poor people, minorities, you know, and Trump, of course, promoting that. So, you know, it's not just what they say, but what they do. But yes, of course, the president is supposed to speak for the nation. He's supposed to speak for the values of the nation. The problem with Trump, among others, is he seems to consider himself the president of those people who voted for him, not of the nation. And he doesn't want to say anything that will annoy the people who voted for him. So he doesn't reach out to those who didn't vote for him, but he is their president now. And, you know, this is not new. This started with his inaugural address, which didn't offer anything, reconciliation, nothing to people who had voted against him. It was all to, you know, whip up the people who were his supporters, and it's been that way ever since. So Trump doesn't really see himself as the president of the American people. He sees himself as the president of a specific group of Americans who elected him, but that's half the country, let us say, not the whole country. And most presidents try to build support outside this base, but he hasn't shown any interest in that.
Talking to historian Eric Foner from Columbia University about presidential leadership and race, President Trump's reactions to Charlottesville over the weekend, yesterday and now today, different messages coming out. Getting back to the whose statue stays up issue, Karen on Facebook writes, the Washington Lee issue is a red herring. Washington never led a rebellion against the United States. Should that participation in that rebellion make us think of people differently, I guess Karen is asking.
I suppose if the British had defeated George Washington in the American Revolutionary War, you wouldn't see too many statues of George Washington around right now. Look, I agree with the point that not every single person who was a slave owner should be denied recognition of one kind or another. But Lee, of course, was the leader of the Confederate armies against the government of the United States. Most places do not honor those who led a rebellion against the government. But as I said, Lee is an important Virginian. I don't really have a big problem with Lee being there if there were statues to other kinds of Virginians. The black Virginians, who were half, 50% almost, or 48% of the population of Virginia were black at that time. Those people were in favor of the Union. Lee didn't represent that. But they don't have a lot of recognition in the public statuary. And as I said, that's because these things are about the present, not about the past. They're about expressing power in the present that they are, you know, whenever the present is that they're put up. So, you know, in a way, it is a red herring. What we really should be talking about is how come African-Americans still, 150 years after the Civil War, are disadvantaged in so many ways.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Gil is with us in Madison. Gil, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, he just spoke to it now. So the point I wanted to make was that these statues they're erecting were people who were enemies of the United States. And I can't see us ever erecting statues to enemies. It would be like putting up a statue of Hitler, because he certainly was part of our history, but we don't honor him or recognize him as a great hero. And even though that state is now part of the United States, that particular part of their history, they were in rebellion against the United States. And to recognize or honor people who rebelled against the Constitution and the United States, I don't think deserve to have statues put up in their honor.
Gil, thanks a lot for the call. Eric, what would be an honest way to represent our history, especially that Civil War era history, that I don't know, would inform our debates today, not kind of muddle them?
Well, you know, in Richmond, Virginia, they actually have at the old Tredegar Iron Works, which is now a kind of national park site museum about the Civil War, they have an interesting way of doing it where you've got like three narratives at the same time. You've got the Confederate view of the Confederate experience of the Civil War, you've got the Northern experience of the Civil War, and then you have the slaves' experience of the Civil War, which is not the same, obviously, as the Confederate. And you sort of get a picture that different people responded to this in different ways, and it affected people in different ways. And Robert E. Lee reflects one of those experiences, but obviously not the whole thing. But, you know, what was the first thing that the American soldiers did? Remember 2003 when they marched into Baghdad? They took down the statue of Saddam Hussein. Remember that? They didn't say, nobody jumped up and said, wait a minute, you're destroying history. Saddam Hussein is part of the history of this country. He may be a bad guy, but, you know, you can't just destroy history. No. When there's a regime change, statues tend to come down in many places. They did that in Russia, right? After the fall of communism, a lot of the statues of Marx or Stalin or others came down. I think they should be stuck in a museum somewhere if they're part of history. But being out in a public place as part of the public presentation of history to the people of Virginia or any state, that's a little different. If the Virginia Museum of Art wants to have a portrait of Robert E. Lee in there, fine, of course they should have that, no problem. But that's the museum presenting a work of art. That's not the city or the state saying, here is the person in Virginia history we ought to admire and emulate. That's a public thing, and it's a little bit different.
Eric, very briefly, we're 150 years out from the Civil War. Are we going to still be arguing about how to represent it in another 50 years?
Yeah, I'm sure we will. I won't be around to hear it, but absolutely. As long as these issues are still alive in American life, of racial inequality, of different groups and relations between these other, of politics and how race plays into that. Unfortunately, I'm afraid in 50 years those issues will still be with us, and therefore the Civil War will still be debated by people.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to talk to you. Bye-bye.
That's Eric Foner, professor of history at Columbia University, author of a number of books on American history, including Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877, and Battles for Freedom, the Use and Abuse of American History. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the president's latest comments on Charlottesville, on how we represent and remember the Civil War era in the United States, and presidential leadership. You can do that over on the Central Time Facebook page.